This is Ken Hollings, and this is Hollingsville. Welcome, traveller. Welcome indeed to the inaugural episode in this new series, Hollingsville, in which we will be examining, through the medium of radio and some of my specially invited guests, certain aspects of our relationship with technology, from bodies to buildings, from machines to monsters. Those of you who possibly recall my previous series, Welcome to Mars, and the book that came out of it, will know that I'm quite fascinated by spaces like the suburban grid that developed after the Second World War and continues to expand in new and interesting ways. And that in turn, I find things like the World Expositions, the International Trade Fairs, the slightly, how can I put it, musty and dusty corners of museums dedicated to technology, quite fascinating. There's still, I think, things to discover in these spaces, in these structures. So, in a sense, Hollingsville is an attempt to create on air a kind of radio expo. And to that end, we will be dealing with a different aspect, a different topic, a different theme in each episode. And I'm hoping that although they're rather specifically cited, they're also going to be splendidly vague and will allow, I hope, the widest possible discussion and sort of tangential comments to come from them. And I guess the World Fair, the Expo, is the proper model for Hollingsville, but it's an old World's Fair. This, if you like, Hollingsville is where the 1964 New York World's Fair still goes on. And this, I think, has a lot to do with how I've begun to view our relationship with technology. I tend to find that I'm looking at it more and more in spatial, geographical terms, rather than purely historical ones or lines of cultural drift or influence. And to that end, I feel that architecture is probably going to be quite a strong motif in this show. I think it's going to produce quite a lot of useful allegorical connections, which, with my guests, I shall be exploring. This, as I said, is the first episode, and it's dedicated to the future, with the subtitle, Suddenly It's 1960. And helping me to go through different notions of the future, how we've constructed it over the years, how we continue to still live in its shadow, I have Steve Beard, the writer, and Matt Jones, designer and infonaut, to talk through different subjects, ideas with me. There will also be a couple of musical interludes by the Hollingsville composer in residence, Graham Massey. They'll be coming up in a little while. And while we're on the subject of music, which I suppose is a kind of temporal version of architecture, a more performance-based kind of architecture, particularly electronic music, I should thank the wonderful Indigo Octagon for creating the opening and closing theme for this show. My thanks to all the people that are involved in the sound of Hollingsville. Suddenly It's 1960. This phrase was actually first uttered in about 1957, and it was part of the Chrysler campaign. They were launching the new 57 model. They were talking about this kind of new line, a forward look for their car designs. So forward, in fact, that they couldn't wait for the 50s to end. So they had to announce, here it is, suddenly it's 1960. And there's something, I find something really engaging about this idea. First of all, the notion that somehow the future is just 3 years away. After all, where does the future begin again? 3 years away? 3 months away? 3 days away? 3 minutes away? This show itself has always felt like part of the future until this exact moment. But it also occurs to me that in its impatience, in its accelerated desire to get into this new decade, the spirit behind this statement is already establishing something that we have, I think, taken for granted for much of the latter part of the 20th century. And we're still struggling with it slightly in the 21st, which is this idea that somehow our development, our culture, our politics, ideology, our social forms and assumptions can be neatly divided up into sort of 10-year segments. In an odd kind of way, the first thing that the 60s gave us was the 1950s. And this is why I went to such lengths to explore it year by year in Welcome to Mars. And what's been quite curious about this line of exploration, I'm not the only one doing it, is that quite often these studies, when looking at the 50s, still tend to look at the latter part of it. So, for example, Megan Prelinger has just done a wonderful book on how American aerospace companies advertised their products, their economic importance, through using artwork by science fiction illustrators. Even though the people that were probably going to end up working at these companies would be sitting at drawing boards, you know, designing ventilation fins and blades. Similarly, Fred Kaplan recently wrote a book that was entirely about 1959, in which he saw a kind of shearing off of one decade from another. But I think it's slightly more complex than that. And I think it also, in a sense, has given us this kind of incremental view of progress, that somehow from this great leap into 1960, which really only was fully articulated with, I think, the New York World's Fair in 1964, where you have General Motors' Futurama ride with electronic music by Ray Scott. You have the marvelously titled Walt Disney Carousel of Progress. How exactly can you have a carousel of progress? That's still, you know, deprives me of sleep on some nights. This spirit kind of carried on through. It was almost like some kind of fault line of logic that had to work itself out as we sort of like shade out of the 60s into the 70s and then the 80s. And even as I'm reeling off these decades to you, you're getting mental pictures of clothes, music, posters, the way people disported themselves from decade to decade, until finally we get to this really fascinating moment of the millennium, which in a sense is almost the big bad decade come to end all decades. It's almost as if each decade as a cultural thing becomes a fold in how we perceive ourselves, a fold in our sort of development, which allows us, if you like, to interpret progress in a kind of easily resolvable way. And that's just fabulous. That's just Jim Dandy until you get to about 96, 97, once you start to go into the millennial fold. And that's when the madness starts. That's when the mass suicides start to take place. That's when suddenly trash culture starts to mix itself up with high art and academic seriousness of mind. More importantly, that's when we start to get more and more worried about what exactly our machines can do. By sort of 97, 98, the computer is beginning to sort of make more and more inroads. When you consider that in 1960, I remember interviewing some of the early phone freaks, some of the early hackers in the phone system. And one of them said, you know, I remember telling my dad in the 60s, I wanted my own computer. And he looked at me like I was crazy, you know, because computers then were the size of rooms. You know, it was the equivalent of saying, oh, I want my own atomic bomb. And so by 97, 98, your parents have probably got a computer by then. Give it 3 or 4 more years and your grandparents are going to have a computer. But just at that point, 97, 98, 99, it's beginning to, you know, the digital regime, as I like to call it, is beginning to sort of encroach. And with it comes the fear, the millennium bug, which is just one of the strangest kind of social, cultural hallucinations, mass hallucinations that I think gripped us. This idea that on the stroke of midnight, December the 31st, 1999, every single computer on the planet was going to recalibrate itself to the big 00, with the result that, well, everything from not being able to program your video to planes falling out of the sky was going to take place. Steve across the studio is smiling at me because, we've been entertained by announcements on the London Underground that due to volcanic ash, which has been spewed out of a volcano in Iceland, planes can't fly. And I think we should watch what happens over the next few months after this, because there was a similar cloud of volcanic ash resulted in incredibly bad weather over Geneva in the late 19th century as a result of Vesuvius exploding. And it meant that Byron Shelley and his wife Mary couldn't really go out and play very much, so they had to stay in and write creepy gothic stories to entertain each other. And it was out of it was under this cloud of volcanic ash that Frankenstein was first created, and indeed Byron's amanuensis Polidori wrote an early vampire story. So, you know, welcome to the future. We are really, really reaching back into some strange past at the moment with this volcanic cloud. I'm feeling positively prehistoric here, actually, to be brutally honest. Howsoever, there we are, 1999, December the 31st, planes about to come out of the sky, people stocking up on shotguns and canned goods, ready for the collapse of civilization as we know it. Or at the very least, that, you know, their video's not going to work. And I have to say, I did have a certain, trepidation, switching my computer on, morning of January the 1st. Actually, it would have been January the 2nd, I think I was too hungover on January the 1st. And relieved to find it worked. And there was a brief period of people sort of shaking their heads going, whoa, what were we thinking? Really, really, really. But I think it was indicative of this sense of a kind of a line completing itself, a timeline suddenly being reduced to zero, double zero in this case. And out of that, I mean, if you look back, if you examine, which I think would be a profitable thing to do during this program as we're looking at the future, if we examine the fin de siècle, the end of the 19th century, their responses were very different. And there was this idea that somehow at the end of every century, there must be this little explosion of creativity and madness and apprehension and enthusiasm. But I wonder very much whether the same kind of thoughts would have gone through the heads of people at the end of the 18th century, the end of the 17th century, whether in fact they constructed history in the same way, that they would see significance in a moment like that. And I have to say that in a sense, you know, on my blog, I remark that progress is for people who can't actually quite take the future. But I'm wondering whether the future without progress isn't in fact just purely apocalyptic. And on that note, I think we'll take our first musical interlude from Graham Massey. This is Skyline Mix 2. Thank you. This is Ken Hollings, and this actually isn't Hollingsville at the moment because we've actually gone off-world for this part of the programme. We're actually in an arcology somewhere in very, very deep space where I've come to talk with designer and infonaut Matt Jones. It's a beautiful space we're in. It's like being in a large botanical gardens, but surrounded by the stars and darkness, and the air's fresh, it's green, and it's altogether very lovely. The future doesn't seem too bad to me, Matt.
Well, you know, once you get comfortable with being your own panspermia, you just make home where your biodome is. And yeah. Here we are. It's very nice.
Yeah, you're bearing in mind that, you know, we're before the 9 o'clock watershed here. How would you define panspermia?
It's not a dance troupe from Top of the Pops in the 1970s. It's the theory that life on Earth comes from out there where we are and right now. And that the kind of the vital spark, the thing that took in the primordial soup is from out there, not from the Earth as its origin.
Funnily enough, I was recently reading some of the sleeve notes that Desmond Leslie wrote for his Music of Tomorrow album, part of that is dedicated to his theory that comets actually are the kind of frozen sperm of new worlds.
Yeah, and I was recently researching and writing a little bit about the wonderful world of the Russian cosmists of the turn of the century, who kind of were very much about the kind of solar system as a kind of biosphere rather than just the Earth as a biosphere, and they have wonderful terms like heliobiology and considering the sun and the Earth as a loop of life rather than just the Earth, just Gaia. It's kind of, you know, it's Gaia and her sisters as a sort of futurist Woody Allen rom-com, writ cosmic, and in Russian, beautiful theories which are now kind of the world of exobiology and the science of exobiology is very credible, and it's, you know, a big part of NASA's mission, and it's part of why we're out here right now.
You mentioned the turn of the century. Do you mean the turn of the previous century?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess I'm still a 20th century locked boy to an extent. I should say the turn of the previous century, early 1900s.
I find that period increasingly interesting from our position in the early part of the 21st century, because it's a period in which you can see all the kind of tensions and torsions of the end of one world and the beginning of another. And, yes. And so in a sense, it seems entirely appropriate that we're in this kind of floating Kew Gardens in deep space, because I tend to think of the architecture of that period as being very much about steel and glass, but steel and glass pretending to be something else, growths, curves rather than flat planes, dragonflies and vines.
Sure, you go from the high Victorian neo-Gothic engineering to, okay, well, we can do that, what else can we do? And you have the deco coming in, you have the kind of high romanticism of the romantic movement in Europe, and you have kind of the pre-Raphaelites and all of those sorts of things kind of back to nature but with added engineering, and as a result in the architecture of the time you have all these wonderful slender glass and steel things happening, you know, as you've mentioned in Kew and, you know, elsewhere across the continent, particularly in kind of Paris at the time. You know, you obviously have the flowering of the Art Deco, and you also have the flowering of the modern movement, and the kind of then the aesthetic of the machine comes in, you know, very, very quickly as a kind of there's such an energy of pendulum swings at that time, you know, between the machine and nature, or the consideration of nature.
And I think
the consideration of the machine is
I think particularly of the flowering of the Paris Metro.
Yeah,
It does the engineering almost literally seems to be coming out of the pavement.
Yeah, yeah, it is like kind of briars coming out of the ground and kind of sprouting out.
This takes us very neatly, I think, to what first made me want to bring you onto this inaugural episode of Hollingsville, which is a post you did for the IO9 website.
Yes.
The city is a battle suit for surviving the future.
Yes.
Which I found absolutely fascinating to read. And I noticed from the comments a lot of other people did as well. It seemed to have sparked off quite a thread of conversation.
Yes.
Could you possibly, just to begin with, just outline the argument that you make in this piece?
Sure. My sort of deep background is, not so deep, but kind of a while back now, I trained as an architect, and I've always been a lover of cities and the way that they have a life to them and have a kind of an ecology to them themselves. And recently there's been an upsurge in the consideration of cities as systems to help us solve some of the problems that we're up against, continuing to live on Earth, considering cities as ecologies and arcologies, and considering them as ways in which to live in more sustainable ways. So it's kind of counterintuitive or counter to the kind of eating granola and wearing kind of angora sweaters and living in a cottage and chopping your own wood is actually the least sustainable way to maintain civilizations on Earth, and actually the kind of 6,000 odd year old history of living in cities is actually the best way of maintaining ourselves with nature rather than aside from nature. And they're very, very, when we get them right and when they get themselves right, they are sustaining and generative economic and ecological systems. And the work of architects who kind of came to prominence in the 1960s, around all of the time of Archigram and the tail end of the cybernetics movement, and all of those kinds of things that we're both fascinated with, like Richard Rogers, Sir Richard Rogers, I should say, now Lord Rogers.
We're actually kneeling when we say that.
We are, yes, we're genuflecting and kneeling and making the proper offerings. He's written two books, Cities for a Small Planet and Cities for a Small Country, which kind of take all of that stuff from the 1960s and where we are now and the technologies that we have at our disposal now, and make the case for cities as systems to enjoy and live in and survive in. The metaphor at the centre of the kind of slightly rambling post that I did for IO9 comes from a science fiction writer, Warren Ellis, who in his graphic novel The Authority created a character called Jack Hawksmoor, who can only live in cities. He's been actually altered by aliens. They've abducted him on a yearly basis on his birthday and done, horrible, wonderful things to him, which enable him to eat pollution and run up walls like the god of parkour. And he actually starts to get sick and dies if he's taken to a kind of Poundbury-style Prince Charles village. He would actually kind of probably spontaneously combust. But he's
wise
the,
move.
He's the patron saint. He's the god. He's the avatar of cities. Spoiler warning. It's unknown why this has happened. It's revealed that he's actually been altered, not by aliens, but by us, but the us of the future. And the us of the future, in order to wrap cities around him, in order to use them to defend humanity against all comers, and not giving too much away. And that's kind of something that, in my instinct and in my passion for cities, feels very familiar. That they feel like a way in which we can not only survive but thrive, and that's what I was trying to get across in the essay by using a lot of references from science fiction and comic books, which I love.
It's interesting also that Archigram themselves, I think they did a Metropolis issue, which was dedicated to science fiction imagery.
Well, yeah, I mean that was their those were their fridge magnets. Those were their Scrabble tiles. That was the stuff that they had no language to describe what they needed to describe. So they took it from comic books, and they took it from particularly from comic books. And it's not so much science fiction as it is Stan Lee. You know, it's very much kind of more that kind of we can all be extraordinary, and we can all be responsible, and we can and that's what this future could promise. It's extraordinary optimism expressed in there, but also beyond the, you know, the walking cities and the blimps and the spandex and the, you know, the Liechtenstein, just extraordinary humanity in there as well. At some places, which I really love.
This notion of people as walking architecture, one of the things that I find particularly encouraging about Archigram thinking is the way in which they are so concerned with how an individual navigates a city, their relationship to that city. Mm. And to me, while at the time it may have seemed far-fetched to connect spacesuits to cities, this idea that you could actually have your own survival suit, that you could just walk through a city with and just bivouac wherever you turn up, happen to be as a sort of an Apollo astronaut, as it were. Mm. It seems to me that actually has been handed down to us in the form of the backpack, that people in cities, I mean, if you're really serious about being in a city, working there and having leisure, you have your backpack, you know, with a water bottle and maps, you have your iPhone.
You probably have several gigabytes of storage, quite a lot of processing power and quite a lot of sensing power. All of these sorts of things, which are now, you know, Archigram is now bought in Dixons. Other high street stores are available. But that's kind of what I was trying to get at. That phrase, people are walking architecture, which is from a 1972 essay, I think, from Archigram, quite a late one, really sort of seemed to be true now and seemed to also be mainstream now. And what did that mean? I'd encourage people who are interested in this to go and look at some of the essays and work of Molly Wright Steenson, who blogs at Active Social Plastic, and she's done a lot of research into Cedric Price, who was one of the main influences in Archigram, mentors of Archigram in some ways, and also kind of himself kind of very much interested in temporary architectures, the influence of cybernetics, the influence of activity and people on environments rather than the other way around.
I'm always impressed by how the 60s still speak to us so directly. To me, it always seems like there was one of these big sort of Cambrian periods of thinking in architecture, network design, Buckminster Fuller's theories on spaceship Earth, etc. And in some ways, McLuhan's theories as well, which I'm particularly interested in. But it does seem to me that we're still kind of picking through the archives of the 60s.
Yeah. I guess, like, we look at it in pop time frames, but if we look at it in kind of longer, you know, in a slightly longer period, we're probably, you know, like I'm painfully aware that I said the turn of the century and I meant the last century. So we're still kind of locked in a little bit there, and we're still kind of wondering how to deal with both the kind of the dangers and the opportunities that the 20th century gave birth to, which is again a theme from some of Warren's work.
It seems that despite its slightly doomy title, The City is a Battlesuit for Surviving the Future, one of the things that you do very persuasively for me is actually reposition how we look at the future, and you reposition it in a very positive way, because you actually answer the baby boomers' rhetorical demand, where's my jetpack?
Sure. I mean, jetpack futures are, that's kind of like a term I used to use a lot when I was working in big companies, because often engineers and inventors often leap to the jetpack future when the future of a backpack with several, probably hundreds of gigabytes of storage in it is more transformative and more disruptive. But now it seems weirdly mundane. Exposing the mundane as extraordinary is one of the ways that you can get really, really excited about futures again, and I tend to use the word futures rather than the future, because obviously it's about what we invent and what we do and how we behave is where we end up or what we extend into. And so for me, that's kind of, that itself is a bit of a survival process or a survival mechanism. As much as it's a career, which is also a verb as well as a noun in my case, and it's also just a lot more fun than doom, I reckon. I mean, look where we are, for goodness sake.
True. Here we are. It's green. It's lovely. There's a little bit of condensation running down the inside of the glass walls. It's a perfect place for a picnic.
Exactly. As long as you don't mind Versailles bars.
Yeah, or the ants chewing through the wiring.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is always a problem. Yeah. Matt, thank you so much.
No,
it's
worries.
Been lovely being out here in deep space.
Isn't
with
it nice?
You.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, thank gorgeous. You. Thank you for the invitation and good luck back down on Hollingsville.
Thank you very much. Thank you. This is Ken Hollings, and this is Hollingsville. You've just been listening to our second musical interlude by Hollingsville composer-in-residence Graham Massey, and before that, a fascinating exchange with designer Matt Jones, recorded actually earlier this morning in deep space. Meanwhile, back to the present, and indeed the future, and I'm very pleased now to bring in my second guest, the writer Steve Beard, who I'm hoping in the latter part of the programme is going to tie a few themes together and add a few of his own, I hope. Steve, welcome.
Well, thanks, Ken. It's a pleasure to be on Hollingsville. And I've listened to what you and Matt Jones have had to say with great interest. And I suppose in terms of my own concerns and my own practice as a writer and as someone who collaborates very often with a visual artist, Victoria Halford, on films and texts, what interests me in terms of thinking about the future is that the future is very often the past that returns to haunt us. Beyond that, we've been talking about the 60s, we've been talking about the 20th century in terms of emblematic instances of futurism in the popular mind. And we can talk about decades, as you did so eloquently at the start of the show. We can talk about centuries, but I'd prefer to think about epochs, really. And if we're going to be thinking about precedents for the future, or about the past returning to us as the future in altered form, then I'd really like to start thinking about the Upper Paleolithic period from thousands of years ago, the Stone Age period, if you like, the time when we were living in tribes, much as many of us like to think that we do now, that we have our subcultural tribe, for example. We were hunter-gatherers. Again, many of us who live in cities think of ourselves increasingly as nomads, moving from habitat to habitat, from not even anymore from job to job, but from project to project, from sexual partner to sexual partner. Also, of course, the peoples of the Upper Paleolithic very often used to live in caves. And perhaps we can begin to think of the way that our homes are being developed in terms of their increasing reduction in size in the first instance as a return to a kind of a womb-like cave, especially with regard to the way that we are now beginning to hang massive TV screens on the walls of these caves in order for us to be entertained. This is not so different from many of the shamanistic practices that the priests of the Upper Paleolithic period used to engage in order to induce visions, visions which were specific to themselves as members of a priestly caste, but visions which all of us now in a more of a democratic period are able to experience for ourselves and increasingly manufacture for ourselves.
It does seem to me, though, it's very interesting you pick up on the notion of the cave after I'd been sort of dragging you down through the pavilions of world's fairs and into sort of like dusty wings of old science museums.
Sure.
The interesting thing about the cave is if you like, its pre-literate status.
Yes.
That there is this notion that somehow literacy, the notion of codifying language, goes hand in hand with built structures, with windows, with doors, with walls, etc. But at the same time, while you were saying that, following on from some of the things Matt was talking about in the previous section, the capsule, the pod, in a sense is a kind of 60s science fiction reinvention of the cave. I was thinking of things like the Nakajin capsule tower in Tokyo,
yes.
Designed by one of the interestingly called the Metabolist.
Yes.
School of architects who began to see buildings actually existing in time rather than space.
Yes.
But I guess what it leads to is, as cave dwellers, how are we constructing our society now? How are we actually integrating ourselves? Or maybe we're not anymore.
Well, it's I guess the idea of a cave structure for me, if you think about the way that prehistoric peoples would have inhabited caves, they would have looked for terrain in the first instance which was conducive to the convenient and easy building of a cave. So very often that's a porous terrain. It's a terrain with lots of holes in. It's a terrain built of limestone, for example. So just recently, myself and my partner Victoria Halford were up in the Peak District in England working on a project, making a film about the science of accident investigation. And we toured the surrounding landscape, less interested in the countryside, more interested in the fact that the Peak District is built from ancient geological strata of limestone. And it's actually a landscape which is porous in this way. And actually, many of the caves there used to be inhabited not only by prehistoric peoples, but by many outlaws and dissidents in succeeding periods. It's also interesting to think that this is not something exclusive to England. We're used to thinking about China now as a place where technological development and the growth of capitalism are happening quickly. So it could be that we begin to think of China as the place where the future has migrated to, if you like. But one of the things that's interesting about the way that China is solving its problems with regard to how do you actually house many of the people who are moving from the countryside to the city is that they're investigating precisely how a cave in a limestone terrain can actually be fitted with a brick interior, and how electric cables can be run in so that people can have their fridges and their electric cookers and their TV screens.
This I find particularly fascinating, because one of the things that was going through my mind when I was putting the notes together for this program and some of the conversation I was having with Matt Jones, when we raised the issue of Archigram in particular, and this notion of actually being nomadic within a city, so you actually find a part of the terrain which you're going to inhabit temporarily, and then you move on. I mean, they used the analogy of the picnic as being a perfect example of this kind of futuristic dwelling in which you kind of plug yourself into the landscape, you know, spread out your blanket, have your picnic, and then you sort of bus yourself afterwards. You clear yourself up and leave the space for someone else. And it seemed to me that a lot of the really fascinating, optimistic, sort of joyful ideas that they were engaging in the early 60s actually occur in exactly the spaces which there is an intellectual tradition of being suspicious of. I'm thinking particularly of like Mark Algay's book, Non-Places.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where he identifies the airport, the shopping mall, the supermarket, the motorway service station as being non-places, places which are geared towards transient populations.
Indeed.
But which are very, very rich in information, but which have no sense of locality.
Yes.
And it occurred to me that putting his observations together with the Archigram design, the Archigram plan for the cities of the future, that that what you end up with is a kind of notion of locality as being something that's located historically. It is, you know, it's positioned in the past, whereas the non-space is the space of the future. I always feel more like I'm in the 21st century when I'm in an airport.
Yes.
I love airports. I can't help it. But I also find it very interesting the way you can, as it were, picnic inside these areas, the way you can set up these temporary little zones.
Yes.
You know, with your own, you know, either using, you know, internet connections within the site, you know, Starbucks is there. Seating's there. I mean, honestly, you know, I could live in a hotel in an airport. I'd be happy to do it. But what you're saying, I'm beginning to feel more like I'd be some kind of 21st century troglodyte. You know?
Indeed, I think there's something to be said for that. That in a way, these new urban nomadic lifestyles are moving us beyond a way of living that was primarily built on agricultural settlement, and Lewis Mumford has written, hasn't he, about the grain silo being the actual archetypal monument of an agrarian culture, because it actually is the visible index of the commitment to the farming of a piece of land and of the occupation of a piece of land by many peoples, and of the building of a city. and of the building of the fortifications around the city as well. And perhaps despite the migrations to the cities that have occurred over the last 200-300 years in the West, and the migrations that are occurring much more quickly now in the East, we still haven't entirely left behind our attachment to these monuments. It could be argued, for example, that the Apollo space program was only the latest example of the attachment to that kind of architecture, that the Apollo rocket was a kind of a grain silo being boosted into space, perhaps in a way for us to detach our imaginations from it and move on.
To me, it's funny you should mention the Apollo program, because I always thought of the first lunar lander as being like, you know, the new suburbs of Earth. You know, that it is, it's a line of logic that starts with the early Levittown conurbations in Long Island in 1947. These perfect, rigid, grid-like suburban areas that suddenly appeared in former agricultural land, and that the non-space actually is a very colonizing space.
Yes.
And if you like, the ultimate non-space is the Sea of Tranquility.
Yes.
In all its sort of desolate splendor, it is for me still a kind of outpost.
Yes.
Of our suburban drift, our suburban ideal. But at the same time, there's this interesting kind of endo-colonization going on now, where in cities which, as it were born out of industry. And I think it's interesting that you mentioned Lewis Mumford, because, I mean, he is one of the first great historians of industrial development.
Sure.
He's the first historian of the city as a kind of industrial entity.
Sure.
That now cities like, for example, Detroit, which were just gutted from the 70s onwards as the automobile industry begins to shrink, and you just had city blocks that were utterly abandoned, that now these are being sort of resettled, and there's now farming communities developing in the heart of Detroit. There's new art projects going on, etc. And you can see, I don't know, similar projects taking place, Sheffield, Liverpool, Manchester, Dortmund, Berlin is, I think, another case in point where you're beginning to see a kind of resettlement of space. But it also occurs to me that, as we sort of progress into the 21st century, and there I use that word again, I was hoping I wouldn't use the word progress, but I just did. Certainly by, say, 2030, which seems to be a magic figure. I've seen all kinds of things predicted for 2030, like, for example, 60% of the planet's surface will be city.
Okay.
By 2030, which is an interesting point. And also a similar, I think, the UN Commission on Housing a couple of 3 years ago, we're saying that, 2030, the entire population of the Earth is going to be based in cities.
Okay.
I agree. You go okay to a statement like that. What else can you do? From the early 20th century, when, probably 7% of the world's population actually inhabited a city, to one in which the entire population inhabited a city. The thing that occurs to me is, by then, isn't our definition of a city changed? Hasn't it become almost like second nature? Hasn't it become a new set of limestone caves?
I guess the key thing to consider here is actually the way in which what we might think of as a distinction between the countryside and the city is actually a little bit more complex than that. And I think that a lot of what you're talking about, isn't it, is actually the suburb. The non-place is actually the kind of suburb or the interurban space. And to an extent, the city is something defined and fortified. It has its exterior, its defensible exterior, has its ramparts. The area which is farmed has its monuments, such as the grain silo, which I mentioned earlier. But then, as I suppose industrial development proceeds, maybe it begins to detach itself from the need for these kinds of fortifications, and fortifications begin to be developed in other ways through the transmission of signs. They begin to be transmitted digitally as well, of course, in terms of the tattooed circulation of information. And maybe this actually permits and makes it easier for cities to link up through the propagation of suburban and interurban spaces. I mean, J.G. Ballard, of course, famously was way ahead of the curve on this. I suppose if this begins to happen, then what begins to happen to the, if you like, classical, defensible city? It either, if it becomes ruined, regresses to become farmland again, as you've mentioned. And if that's happening in Detroit, it's no surprise, given that we've already been through a previous moment of being fascinated by the ruins of Detroit. But maybe another fate for the city under that circumstance is simply to be hollowed out in a way and become a kind of a tourist spectacle, which you can certainly see happening to many parts of London at the moment.
It's interesting you use the term hollowing out, because this reminds me of, it was the term that Walter Benjamin used when he was describing Nietzsche's later style, his writing. Yeah. He referred to this kind of hollowing out of text. And it always, you know, in a sense, we've been dancing around science fiction all the way through this sure. this program, which I'm happy to do. And to me, science fiction is, I see it functioning in the way that Benjamin saw the Jugendstil or Art Nouveau as functioning, yeah. as a means of kind of accommodating, dealing with the forces that propel the future. You know, progress happens through us, despite us. No one yeah. individually progresses. We do it collectively, and it seems to be a force that goes through us. And what I found really interesting is Benjamin's notion. He talked about three lines in Jugendstil, which I think would actually follow science or parallel science fiction very well. He talked about the three lines of vice, emancipation, and priesthood. And it seems okay. to me that, you know, I mean, you came up with this wonderful term, Voodoo Science Park. And for me, the Voodoo Science Park is the home of all three.
Voodoo Science Park, yes, that describes the film that I made about the science of accident investigation with the artist Victoria Halford. And that very much is a film that's seeking to make visible the ways in which we actually construct the future and how those dreams can redeem some of the greatest collective wishes that humanity has for itself from the past.
And I think we are about ready to pack up our little picnic rug and our hamper and our vacuum flask and pick up our tour guide and roll credits, because you have been listening to episode 1 of Hollingsville. The future, suddenly it's 1960, featured contributions from guest speakers Steve Beard and Matt Jones. My thanks to both of them for taking part in this program. Music was by the Hollingsville composer in residence, Graham Massey. Special thanks will also go to Indigo Octagon for creating the show's spiffy opening and closing themes, which I'd like to hear anytime now, thanks. And I would also like to thank Tom Besley for engineering my conversation with Matt Jones. And my thanks also to Hannah Brown, who's overseen the entire live broadcast from within the studio. Please do tune in for the next episode, episode 2, Media, The Extensions of God, when my guest speakers will be Russell Davies and Gary Latchman. This is Ken Hollings, and this has been a Project Thrust production. Project Thrust, the name you can trust.